There have been reports of UFOs controlling our missile sites. It's an amazing story uncovered by Robert Hastings, and he is our guest next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a great guest for you for the next couple hours. I had the privilege a very short time ago of meeting Robert Hastings at one of our Beyond Belief television tapings. Robert is a UFO researcher, lecturer, author, filmmaker. He has researched declassified U.S. documents that confirm that UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites occurred as early as 1945, even before the end of World War II. Robert has also interviewed more than 150-plus U.S. Air Force veterans who were involved in one or more of these incidents. Now, back around 2010, CNN live-streamed his UFOs and nukes press conference in Washington, D.C., which seven of those veterans discussed still classified incidents involving UFOs shutting down these nuke missile sites during the Cold War era as well. He's got a film called UFOs and Nukes, his book UFO and Nukes as well. And Robert, it's a pleasure to have you on Coast to Coast with me. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, George.
This is an incredible story. Now, when this all started for you, you've been a UFO researcher, you're a lead investigator. How did you come across this?
My father was career Air Force, and in 1966, 67, we were stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which is a nuclear missile base. There were rumors that strange aerial objects were flying around the nuclear missiles. My father worked in a building called the SAGE building, which was basically a large group of radar scopes, state-of-the-art, actually synced with other Air Force radar installations around the nation. And they were picking up objects traveling thousands of miles per hour, objects that were capable of doing things, zigzag flight patterns that no aircraft can do even today. And again, the rumors were that these objects, at least on some occasions, were flying around and even hovering over the nuclear missiles outside of the base. By 1973, after I graduated from college, I came across two different sources, one a book by Raymond Fowler called UFOs, Interplanetary Visitors, in which he mentioned the fact that he was a civilian Minuteman missile contractor for Sylvania Corporation, in addition to being a UFO researcher. And while he was with Sylvania, his contacts at Malmstrom were confirming that indeed UFOs were hovering over the missiles and causing them to malfunction, although he knew a great deal more than he said back in the early 70s about this. So by the end of 1973, I decided this was real, this was important, and I began informally at first seeking out and interviewing military veterans, some of whom said, you know, UFOs, are you nuts? others said, you know, I know what you're talking about, but I can't talk about it. And then some others said, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I was involved in one thing or another. So I started tape recording these people, and by 1981, I felt I had enough information to go public and tell the American public via the college lecture circuit that military veterans, persons who were involved with nuclear weapons in one capacity or another, were in large numbers, increasingly large numbers as the years went on, and I found new people to interview, were coming out and saying that UFOs not only exist, but they routinely monitored our nuclear missiles and other weapon sites, and on some occasions had disrupted the functionality of those weapons. Obviously, this is an important story for reasons that I can't entirely explain, frankly. I felt so strongly about this. I've devoted my life to this research. And as you've mentioned, I have produced a book and now a film trying to acquaint the American public and the world, you know, humans across the board with the reality of this situation.
Initially, when they started telling you these stories we'll get into, did you believe them?
Well, I already had from my father, who worked at the SAGE building, you know, the sense that the radar guys are saying, you know, they're tracking objects that are doing things that no aircraft on Earth can do.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, you know, the people who weren't in the loop, I'm sure the intelligence people knew what were going on. But my dad not being directly involved with that, just having contacts within the radar group at the SAGE building, knew that these people were taking this deadly seriously and were reporting to their superiors. And, you know, when Raymond Fowler in 1973 said, I was a civilian contractor on the Minuteman program, and we were getting the same story that disc-shaped objects were coming in, hovering over the missiles, and the missiles were malfunctioning. So, yes, by the time I began getting firsthand accounts from these veterans over the course of the 1970s into the 80s, I was dead, you know, I was quite certain that this was absolutely real. And I did very early on get some indication indirectly that I was on the right track and somebody wasn't happy with what I was doing. I went out on the lecture circuit in September of 81. By December of 81, I was getting national publicity. And shortly thereafter, apparently someone took notice, someone in Washington, presumably. And in early 82 is when I first noticed this, when I would call veterans on the phone and with their permission record their statements to me. After every one of those conversations, without fail, as soon as I hung up, I thanked the veteran for speaking with me, hung up, within a minute or 5 minutes, I would get a call from somebody who said nothing into the phone. I could hear background noises. And then after 30 seconds or so, they would hang up without saying a word. And this only happened when I got done speaking with one of these veterans. It never happened at any other time. Huh. So clearly someone became aware of what I was up to and was just making it known to me, probably trying to intimidate me.
Yes.
Just stopping it, knocking it off, to stop calling these veterans and getting these guys to talk about still classified incidents. I've told people I guess I was too stupid to be scared because I just kept it up. And, you know, I now have over 150 veterans, as you mentioned, seven of whom attended my CNN stream press conference in 2010, willing to talk to the world about this. The media was very interested for about a week after that press conference, and then they seemingly lost interest in this earth-shaking story that's just beyond me.
Oh, it is an amazing story. Now, for the unknowing, Robert, would you explain, kind of paint us a picture of what a nuclear site looks like?
Well, in the case of the Minuteman missile systems, which is what we have in place today, you basically have an underground launch control capsule manned by two officers, a commander and deputy commander. They're in charge, or they're in control of 10 nuclear missiles, and that's called a flight. 10 underground missile silos controlled by the Central Launch Control Facility. Now, the Air Force now calls them Missile Alert Facilities, MAFs, but for many, many years they were called launch control capsules. The officers are 60 feet underground. They cannot see these objects in the air, but the security personnel at ground level, either out at the missile silos themselves or within the building above the underground launch control capsule, are calling down to the capsule and saying, you know, in some cases in a very panicky voice, you know, there's this strange object hovering over the missile site. What do we do? And dozens, literally dozens of launch control officers have now gone on the record with me on tape, either audio tape or videotape, saying that they could clearly tell that the guards were panic-stricken. They were reporting this large object hovering over the missile site or the launch control capsule. And before they had really any time to respond and try to address this or even say, you know, to the guard in some cases, what have you been drinking? You know, they were incredulous that this was actually going on. Their missiles began dropping offline, began malfunctioning one after the other. Quite clearly. And then, you know, after the missiles drop offline, malfunction, the object zooms away. Most of these launch officers that I've talked to have said that they were then debriefed by usually OSI, Office of Special Investigations agents. It's an Air Force counterintelligence group, were sworn to secrecy, in many cases were forced basically at the, you know, risk of their career to sign what are called national security non-disclosure statements, saying that if, you know, they sign this document, if they subsequently speak to anyone, even themselves, they were told not to talk to the other officer involved, they were subject up to 10 years in jail and $10,000 fine. So quite clearly, the Air Force took this deadly seriously. This was a national security matter, and this has occurred at virtually every nuclear missile base in the nation year after year, decade after decade.
How many sites do we have in the United States, Robert? 1,000 more?
Well, the number of missiles, I believe the latest reduction treaty that we had with the Russians, I believe we're down to just over 1,000 in place, deployed, but we still have very large stockpiles on both sides of the ocean. The missile, at the end of the Cold War, the missile fleet was reduced in number. There are, at this point, three bases remaining, and that's F.E. Warren in Wyoming, Cheyenne, Wyoming, Malmstrom again in Great Falls, Montana, and then Minot in Minot, North Dakota. But again, each one of these has, for example, I believe Malmstrom still has 150 missile sites, 15 flights. The last I heard, that was the number that were in place. So we have very large quantities of missiles. And as a quick aside, I just mentioned the Russian treaty we have with the Russians. We now know, largely due to George Knapp, your colleague on
Coast, he's Coast, the best for this.
Investigative journalist, he actually smuggled documents from the Soviet regime after that had collapsed. In he was in Russia interviewing various former Soviet military personnel. One of them, Colonel Sokolov, actually allowed him to take out still classified top secret documents. I mean, I'm amazed that, you know, George would do that. That's pretty courageous.
That's gutsy. That's gutsy for him.
As a result of that action, we know that the Soviets had the same problems with UFOs maneuvering near their missile sites, and in some cases, causing the missiles to actually go into activation to launch mode.
Wow!
For 15 seconds, for example, on October 4th, 1982, at this missile base in Soviet Ukraine, the documents that George smuggled out indicate that for 15 seconds, an unspecified number of missiles went into actual launch mode and were preparing to actually, you know, hit some targets in the West. And after 15 seconds, this malfunction ceased and everything returned to normal. And the report indicates that follow-up inspections could indicated no anomaly. They couldn't figure out, you know, what had caused the problem. In terms of hardware malfunctions.
Didn't we go on hard alert? We went on a big alert there, didn't we?
I don't think we did in that particular case, but, you know, the punchline to the story is that at the moment that these missiles went into countdown mode, there was a large disc-shaped object that hundreds of people on the base, according to these documents, saw hovering directly over the missile base. I have actually, and in my film, which is available at Vimeo on demand, UFOs and Nukes, The Secret Link Revealed, I actually have a brief excerpt from my interview with a man named David Shure, who is a former Air Force captain, missile launch officer at Minot in 1966, who tells virtually the identical story, that an object was moving from missile to missile in his flight at Minot, and as he would get reports over the telephone from the guard saying it's now over E2, suddenly E2 would go into launch mode, and they would have to flip what was called an inhibit switch to prevent the launch of that missile. And this occurred with, he said, most, he thinks, maybe 8 or 9 of his 10 missiles.
Jeez.
Went into temporary launch mode. Now, the American people never heard this story, you know.
No.
And yet it went on. And so the Pentagon, you know, people say, oh, we don't know if there's a UFO cover-up or not. Well, if you just watch the testimony of my veterans on camera or on audio tape, you know, it's quite clear that some just tremendously important things have taken place and been successfully suppressed by the U.S. government.
Robert, did these objects just appear over the sites, or could you clearly see them coming in from over the horizon, for example?
The description that I've gotten not only from the missile personnel, the guards who were at ground level who saw the objects with their own eyes, but also the radar people at Malmstrom. I have a whole chapter in my book devoted to tape-recorded testimony from air traffic controllers at the Malmstrom Tower during that era, and they say these objects were just flying thousands of miles per hour. They would stop instantly. The guards say that, you know, the thing was just a teeny little point of light, and 1 second later, it was huge. It was as big as the side of a barn in just the blink of an eye. So these things didn't glide in slowly. They just kind of zoomed in real quickly, hovered for a few seconds, and zoomed off, you know, before anyone could collect their wits. So, yeah, that's the predominant description that's been provided to me, not only by the eyewitnesses, the security personnel, but the radar personnel who track these objects.
Russia, Israel, China, North Korea, India, Pakistan, they all have nukes. They all have nuke sites. Have any of those countries reported the same thing happening there?
It's difficult enough for me to get information from Americans. And of course, when I'm trying to track down stories that have come out of Russia or the former Soviet Union, that's infinitely harder. You know, George Knapp had his contact by going over there and actually doing on-site interviews shortly after the collapse of the Soviet regime. He said 1 year later, when he tried to follow up with these people, they all shut up. So clearly, someone got to them and said, you shouldn't be talking to Western journalists about this. So there was this window of opportunity that he was able to take advantage of and get these people on the record about. But there are on the internet from credible sources, from the mainstream media in both India and Pakistan, for example, who are arch enemies, who both have nuclear weapons, as you've said, that back in the late 90s, when both countries were testing their nuclear weapons underground, there were all sorts of UFO sightings around those test areas, according to the Indian and Pakistani media. So, yeah, it's universal. Anyway, any country that has nukes has had this problem. The French, who are also nuclear power, there are reports from their test sites back in the 1970s in the South Pacific, in French Polynesia, when they were testing weapons in the atmosphere, of multiple UFO sightings all during those tests. There have been reports in the Negev Desert in Israel above the Israelis, chief's nuclear weapons reactor, of UFO activity. So it's universal.
Just unbelievable. We'll get into some real stories in a moment, Robert, from what you've been able to uncover. But let me ask you this, in the moments that we have, why are they doing this? What's the message they're trying to convey here?
I've said for many years now, again, I went out on the lecture circuit in 81, and I am of the opinion that the technology that's being described and being tracked on radar is so advanced, it's orders of magnitude beyond any fixed-wing aircraft that we and the Russians and any other country have. That tells me we're dealing with an outside third party. The most likely source are beings from another world. Who they are, how they get here, why they would even care about human affairs, who knows? All of those big questions are unanswered at this point. But I think it's clear that they've taken an interest. I mean, it's so documented now in the testimony I've brought to light, as well as declassified documents that a number of researchers have accessed. It's clear that whoever they are have taken an interest in monitoring ours and the Russians, the Soviets' missiles, and are tampering with them. Now, one scenario might be they understand that we're basically a primitive race. We have a violent history, and you know, current affairs indicates we're not really any less violent than we were 2,000 years ago. And now we have weapons that can not only destroy our civilization, but radioactively pollute the planet. Are they stepping in and wagging a finger at us? Are they trying to tell us that we're playing with fire? That's my hope. But if they have a presence here, if they have projects here, if they have bases here, God knows, you know, if we had a full-scale nuclear war, we would probably disrupt or impact to some degree their own projects.
Well, that's a good point. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to take a quick break, come back and talk more about this incredible story, UFOs and nukes. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Robert Hastings with us as we talk about the incredible work he's done, UFOs and nukes, and his documentary film of the same name. And Robert, I want to, in a moment, have you tell us where we can still get the books and look at the documentary as well. But some of these investigations that you've done, wow me with some of the great stories that you've been able to pick up out there.
Well, as I've repeatedly said, I'm just the messenger. For whatever reason, I've dedicated my adult life to this subject. As long as there are new nuclear weapons on Earth, we humans being fallible, there is a potential for their use. There's a chapter in my book called Lucky So Far, in which I talk about 20 incidents that either the American or Russian government have now divulged that during the Cold War, we almost went to war at least 20 times. We were minutes away from nuclear war. The best known case is the Cuban Missile Crisis, but there were 19 others that have been admitted to where we mistook what the other guy was doing, or we thought he was doing, and we were about ready to launch our missiles, or the Russians were. That's unbelievably frightening, obviously. So I think it's important to note that the people that I've been interviewing were entrusted by the U.S. government to literally initiate World War III by turning keys and launching nuclear missiles that would have destroyed millions of people's lives and targets all over the Soviet Union. And these people now, at least 150 of them, missile launch officers, targeting officers, missile maintenance officers, and the security personnel are all saying that UFOs have monitored our nuclear missiles and other weapon sites for decades. And on some occasions, when these objects have hovered over them, the missiles have malfunctioned. You know, I'm just the middleman. Again, I'm the one that's collected these testimonies. What I have to say about this is less important than what these gentlemen have to say about it. They're courageous, they're patriots in the first order. They're coming forward and literally putting, you know, their reputations on the line. Some of them have been frightened about their retirement pay going away. It won't. But that's one of the fears. It's one of the cards that the government plays. You know, if you've talked about this, then you're gonna get it, buddy. Well, these courageous people are still, in the face of all of these, you know, personal factors, willing to talk to CNN live at my press conference, or willing to talk on tape in my movie, and you know, all of us owe them a debt of credit.
When these witnesses come forward to you, are they hiding their names and faces?
Very few. The ones, you know, some of them, when they first approach me and they tell me off the record what occurred to them, I say, let's get you on tape. Some of them have waited as long as 5 or 10 years before they're willing to finally do that. Most of them, however, when they approach me, they've already crossed that line. They've already decided, you know, damn it, this is real, this is important. I am going to go ahead, you know, come hell or high water and talk about this. And so in my book, in my film, you know, 98% of my sources allow us to use their name. We tried to get the journalists, the media, to interview these people after the press conference with very little success. You know, only a very small percentage of people have said, you know, I may eventually let you identify me publicly, but not at this time.
When some of these cases have occurred, Robert, besides the shutting and controlling, has anything dangerous happened? I mean, truly dangerous?
Well, you know, when these missiles were activated for launch, for the period that they were actively counting down for launch, you know, that was potentially unbelievably dangerous. In the case that George brought back from the Soviet Union, apparently the missile shut down or activated for 15 seconds and then shut down of their own accord. Probably whoever was in the craft hovering above the missile base both activated and shut down the missiles. Mm-hmm. But the launch officers apparently were just panic stricken. They didn't know what to do. They were, you know, just terrified that World War III was about to start.
Oh my God.
In the cases, actually, there's more than one that I know about in the U.S. where the missiles temporarily activated. The missile launch officers themselves flipped this inhibit switch and shut them down. I have to hope that whoever aboard the UFO activated the missiles had the ability to shut them down as well, if the procedures that the officers took didn't work. I don't think that anyone's trying to start World War III I think what they're doing is either trying to terrify the nuclear powers that they do have the ability to launch these missiles if they want to, or, you know,
or shut them down.
That they're possibly trying to learn how these launch systems work, so they're activating them temporarily to monitor what's going on, to see what the electronics are, and knowing full well that it can shut them down. I hope that's what's going on. In any case, obviously, no nuclear missiles have ever launched.
Could they just have, in all seriousness, a bizarre sense of humor, and they're playing this game?
Let's hope not.
Yeah, because it's not funny.
No. It, I mean, you know, I can't imagine, you know, again, there are, in my opinion, there are indications that they have a presence here. They've probably been here as long as humanity has been around.
I mean, I think they seeded us. I think the Zechariah Sitchin theory of the Anunnaki and the Sumerians, I think that's probably what happened with us. So they've been around since the beginning of time.
So regardless, I mean, I won't be able to agree with you on that necessarily, but just in general, broad terms, I think they have been here for a long, long time. They do have a presence here. There are, in my opinion, credible stories of what appear to be underground bases, not in New Mexico, that's a hoax, but around the world, there are indications of objects flying out of the water or flying into the mountain, a mountain in the Andes, and so on. So if they have bases here, they have a vested interest in keeping the integrity of the planet intact. And if there were a major nuclear war, there would be all sorts of repercussions that undoubtedly would affect their projects here, I would think. So, you know, that's okay with me if they have selfish interests, you know, as long as, you know, the people in the Pentagon and the Kremlin understand that somebody does control the missiles other than our own military and the Russian military. And hopefully sooner or later, somebody will finally get it through their head that maybe we shouldn't have these weapons, which is what I'm hoping. Let me, as a quick aside, before I forget to mention it, this Thursday evening in Albuquerque, my film, my documentary film, will have its theatrical premiere. It is available on Vimeo On Demand, but we're going to put it on a big screen in Albuquerque,
great,
New Mexico at the Chemo Theater, Thursday, June 23rd at 7 p.m. And if someone wants to come down and see it, I am going to have an open-ended question and answer session following the film. If you don't get a chance to get through tonight and talk to me, if you live in Albuquerque or central New Mexico and you want to come out, I guarantee I will spend an unlimited amount of time talking to you. I should also mention that I've been invited to be the keynote speaker at the MUFON Symposium in Orlando in late August. I believe it's August 25th through 28th. In any case, if anyone's interested in attending that, I will be the keynote speaker. We are also going to show the film, I believe, I've been told that we will, at one of the venues during that conference as well.
When you're done seeing the film, do you walk away with shivers? Does it have that kind of effect on people, Robert?
I have been getting hundreds and hundreds of emails in the 2 months that the film has been at Vimeo On Demand. People saying this is amazing, this is excellent, this is profound. These are not words that I am making up. These are what people are telling me. So I think, you know, you can hear me talk about these witnesses, these launch officers divulging these amazing things, but to actually see them on camera talking about it, I mean, these guys are in their 70s and 80s. They have nothing to gain by going public at this point in life. They don't want anything out of it except the public enlightenment that will come from people taking what they have to say seriously. So I, you know, obviously we had a budget of $150,000. This is not Close Encounters, which costs millions and millions of dollars, but it is a 48-minute film that looks at the history of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites. And again, the testimony, the feedback I've been getting from people from all over the world, not only Americans who've seen the film online, I've apparently succeeded in making my point.
Good for you. Good for you. Have any of these veterans that have spotted these craft afterwards, have they been so shaken up that they're just not the same anymore?
Some of them, I think, you know, these people are trained to, you know, launch weapons of mass destruction. They have to have a certain kind of very solid, grounded mindset to first, in the first place, to even be qualified to do that kind of work. So most of the guys I've talked to, and again, they're describing things that occurred decades ago, but most of them said that when they got the call from their guard stop sign saying that there's this large glowing object hovering over the front gate, you know, they, almost without exception, they wanted some verification. Some of them said to me, you know, I was inclined to ask this guy what he'd been drinking, but it was apparent from the panicky voice, and sometimes the guards were described as screaming into the phone, but it was clear these people were serious. They weren't joking around. And then the capper, you know, within seconds, in some cases, the missiles began to malfunction. And it was clear that something very serious was going on. And then on top of it, most of them are either given verbal admonishments by their commanders not to talk about it, or more often than not, this OSI agent shows up at the base when they're back at the base. And again, they're basically threatened. Not only with their career being ended, but actual incarceration if they talk about this. So it's made deadly serious to them that, you know, this is real, this is national security, and you will not talk about it. And yet, you know, they're willing, even though these are technically still classified top secret, these incidents. I've got, you know, well over 150 people now going public and saying, you know, damn it, the public needs to know about this.
In these cases that seem to be cropping up all over the place, are they still happening now?
The last incident that I mentioned in my film occurred in 2010. And interestingly, it was not even a month after the nationally covered press conference in Washington on September 27, 2010. Less than a month later, October 23rd, 2010, at F.E. Warren Air Force Base, there was a massive communications failure where suddenly the base could not contact, could not talk to five separate launch capsules. And the total number of missiles that these capsules control were 50 nuclear missiles. If there had been, God forbid, you know, a crisis, an international crisis, if the president had attempted to launch nuclear missiles at presumably Russia, these five capsules would not have gotten the message to do that, would not have gotten the communication to be able to do that. There were apparently backup systems in place, an airborne launch system, but the key thing that was leaked to the media by a man named Mark Ambinder, who was an associate editor at the Atlantic website, I cover that in my film, you know, the fact that this leaked out is remarkable in itself. The Pentagon had to admit it. If it had not leaked out to, if the Atlantic website had not published the story, I'm sure the Pentagon would have kept quiet about it. When I heard this incident, I went, I will bet you there's a 50-50 chance there were UFO sightings during this incident. Sure enough, in December, 2 months later, I actually tracked down somebody who had contacts, active duty missile maintenance technicians at the base. This gentleman is mentioned in my book. I'm not going to identify him here, but he was a retired nuclear missile targeting technician. And within a week, he had gotten back to me and said, yes, they were reporting a huge cigar-shaped object. Multiple missile maintenance teams out in the missile field during this incident were coming back to the base and independently reporting this large cigar-shaped object, which apparently was huge. Wow. Now, the Pentagon will only admit that the incident occurred for 59 minutes. What this source told me, and from the, you know, directly from these two missile maintenance techs, active duty, who were out in the field addressing the problem, apparently the problem was intermittent for 25 hours. It actually lasted more than a day, which the Pentagon is not admitting. And all through that 23rd of October and the following day on the 24th, reports of this huge cigar-shaped object were coming in. In fact, one of the missile maintenance techs said that the commander of the missile maintenance squadron had a squadron-wide meeting and said, if you saw something in the sky, the exact quote was, you will not talk about something, quote, things that you may or may not have seen in the sky, was the quote that I got. So quite clearly, in my view, from the people who are out in the field trying to bring the missile, the systems back online, the communication systems, there were independent reports all over this huge missile field from guards, from not only guards accompanying the missile maintenance teams, but the team members themselves, of UFOs, a UFO being sighted during this incident.
And Robert, so not that we... Go ahead.
It's still going on, is the short answer.
Okay. Not that we should be engaging them, but I thought we had some kind of defense systems all around our bases. Nothing?
Well, interestingly, the closest base where fighters could be launched, in fact, they were, as I independently learned from a number of civilian reports, I believe it's Buckley. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the Air Force base near Denver, but jets were sent up from Denver to chase objects in the sky for a several-week period following this incident. I actually went up to the area and enlisted the services of a local law enforcement person who I'm not going to identify, who helped me. He actually set up interviews with civilians who had reported UFOs around that time frame. These are people who had farms and ranches with missile silos on their ranches.
Yeah.
And I actually interviewed 16 civilians independently who all reported UFO activity in the days and weeks following this incident where the communications were lost at F.E. Warren Air Force Base, including witnesses who described jet fighters, clearly military fighters, racing after bright, strange objects in the sky over their property. So this was not an isolated event. It was ongoing in certainly the weeks and months following the main event on October 23rd, 2010.
It is Buckley, by the way. That's okay. Near Aurora, Colorado. So that's probably...
I've reached the age. I'm 66 now, and I'm starting to forget names and locations and dates. So
not to worry. You do a great job.
Bear with me.
I want to go through some emails that you've received as well and get some of your thoughts on this. These cases of UFOs showing up over sites, when was the earliest report? Have you been able to get that?
Well, it didn't involve missiles because missiles were not yet in use except in Germany and Nazi Germany, mm-hmm. but... in 2009, I was contacted, I'm going to draw a blank on his name, a U.S. Navy veteran, Bud Clem, contacted me. I got his military orders. He was a Navy fighter pilot in World War II. He told me that his fighter squadron in January of 1945 was based at a place called Naval Air Station Pasco in Washington State, right across the river from the Hanford site. The Hanford site was a plutonium production facility that created the plutonium for the bomb that was detonated in New Mexico, the Trinity test, as well as the bomb dropped on Nagasaki. The Hiroshima bomb was uranium-based.
Hold on for a second, Bob. I'll have you pick that up when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Plus, we'll take some phone calls with Robert Hastings as we talk about UFOs and nukes.